I'm Matthew Byrne. I head up the Cincinnati Lawyers Chapter, and it's my distinct honor today to introduce Ohio's 51st Attorney General, Dave Yost. Attorney General Yost earned his undergraduate degree from The Ohio State University and his law degree from Capital University. After working as a reporter for the Columbus Citizen's Journal, he was elected as Delaware County Auditor and then Delaware County Prosecutor. As prosecutor, Mr. Yost won the first ever capital case in Delaware County and took down the largest drug ring in the county's history. Mr. Yost was elected as Ohio's State Auditor in 2010. He spent the next 4 years fighting fraud, rooting out corruption, and working to skinny down state government. In two terms as state auditor, Mr. Yost helped convict 170 corrupt public officials and uncovered $30 million in stolen and misspent public funds. He also promoted efficiency by identifying potential savings of $287 million for governments and school districts. At his urging, the General Assembly twice enhanced charter school accountability. In November of last year, 2018, Mr. Yost was elected as Ohio's 51st Attorney General. This is Mr. Yost's third time speaking to this Federalist Society statewide conference. It's a pleasure to have you back, and we're happy to hear from you. Thank you.
Thank you. It's great to be back here and to be able to speak with you a few moments this morning. I have had the great privilege of seeing at a distance two remarkable public careers. Speaker Batchelder, of course, being an iconic leader of conservatives in Ohio and really across the nation. And of course, Judge Batchelder on the 6th is someone we all know and respect for her commitment to the rule of law. I have heard a rumor, I have not been able to confirm this, but that the speaker, I'm told, is contemplating a book about Judge Batchelder's experience wading through the liberal politics that sometimes attend to some of the jurisprudence. When I was a prosecutor, we used to call the 6th Moscow on the Ohio. I have no idea whether this rumor is true, but the rumor is that Speaker Batchelder has tentatively titled the book Alice in Wonderland. It's sure to be a bestseller there. I was asked, and I'd like to talk to you about a case in just a moment, but I was asked to begin today by talking a little bit about the question of the statutory duty that a government attorney, particularly an attorney general, has to defend state enactments. And it's a very timely question because I spent a great deal of the last year and a half thinking about this question. I recall, for example, the controversial case of the clerk down in Kentucky who refused to comply with Obergefell. And as a matter of conscience, a sticky set of facts for somebody like me who prizes religious liberty and yet at the same time recognizes the duty of a public official to faithfully execute their duties. And so as I've thought through these things, I've come to the conclusion that just as Justice Scalia used to talk about abortion. People would come up to him and say, I so appreciate your commitment to life. You know, we appreciate your vote and you sticking up for life on the Supreme Court. And I'm told, I did not know the late justice, but I'm told by people who did, that his response was that he was indeed ardently committed to pro-life. He's a devout Catholic. But that had nothing to do with his jurisprudence, that his opposition to abortion stemmed from the fact that there's no right to abortion in the Constitution. And he would follow it up by saying that if there were a right to abortion in the Constitution, it would be his duty as a justice of the Supreme Court to uphold that, because that was his oath. And so to answer the question about the Ohio Attorney General, I believe it's my duty, regardless of the wisdom or my perception of the merits of a particular statute, to defend it, because that's the oath I took, was to uphold and faithfully execute the laws and the Constitution of both the United States and the state of Ohio. So where do you come then? What happens if you've got a real problem? Well, there's two instances where this can come up. And the first is simply where you've taken a adverse position publicly that makes you incapable of being an advocate. And I will always remember an instance when I was the Delaware County prosecuting attorney. In addition to putting bad guys away, you're also the civil lawyer for all of the county agencies, including, as it turns out, for the purpose of this story, the Board of Elections. Now, personally, I've been bored with elections for a long time, but and this is made even juicier by the fact that my former law partner happened to be the president of the Board of Elections the year this particular issue came up. They had come up and they had a nominating petition that had some defects, and there was a challenge to it, and we were asked to weigh in and give some advice to the board, and I and my staff created a wonderful, well-reasoned, perfectly sound legal opinion. And the reason I know this is because there was a Supreme Court case on all fours. How often does that happen, right? I mean, we hear about it in a case on all fours in law school, but you never find one. But this was on all fours. The Supreme Court said it's a fatal flaw. You cannot put it on the ballot. You cannot cure. There's nothing you can do. And so I wrote a strongly worded letter that told them exactly what it was and predicted that if they went ahead and put it on the ballot anyway, they would be sued and lose. Well, up came the public meeting, and my former law partner persuaded his non-lawyer colleagues on the Board of Education that they should favor ballot access, and even if the law didn't come out so much on their side, they were still striking a blow for democracy, and they all voted to put this on the ballot. And then when they were asked by the news media if they could see my letter, they gave it to them, thereby waiving attorney-client privilege. My letter was Exhibit A on the lawsuit on an expedited elections matter in the Supreme Court. And obviously, at this point, I was conflicted. We had to have outside counsel do that. And so the first time, or the first kind of thing that would create a problem is if I've taken a public position inadvertently, as in that case, or purposely, I think if you have argued a contrary position, you probably need to have somebody not in your office argue the case. The second is a matter of conscience. And at that point, one has to determine whether it's really a matter of conscience or simply a matter of strongly held opinion. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the problems with our political discourse today is we have mistaken opinions for principle, and we've mistaken principles for matters of conscience and divine purpose. There does come a time when everyone has to decide whether they can even participate tangentially, having outside counsel to participate in a case. And if that day, if that dilemma would ever be presented to me, I think the only remedy is to resign the office. However, I would suggest that if we think carefully about what it is we're dealing with, we would find that an awful lot of things that we think are just a non-negotiable really, in fact, are a little bit more malleable than we might think. And there's perhaps perhaps fewer things more malleable than a judge trying to discern the intent of Congress. Which turns me to the case I want to speak with you about this morning. That we recently filed an amicus brief. Ben Flowers, I think, is there's Ben. Ben, would you stand up? Ben Flowers, your solicitor for the state of Ohio. And somebody everybody in this room knows from his work at the Federalist Society. He did a great job with this. It was a great honor for me to participate in the forming of the brief, but the writing is his, including the fabulous line that I think will be chiseled in marble over a courthouse somewhere, someday. Let justice be done, though the heavens fall. Texas versus the United States is an Affordable Care Act challenge, the third major challenge to wind its way through the courts. First two, of course, being NFIB and King v. Burwell. And in this case, it stems from the individual mandate, which in 2017, the United States Congress reduced the penalty for failing to comply with the individual mandate to zero. Now, many of the people in this room will recall King versus Burwell and the really remarkable set of opinions that came along with that decision. Nobody could quite garner five votes to say that it was permissible under the Commerce Clause. Something, by the way, that I can attribute to the long work of the Federalist Society generally to mainstream textualism and federalism. Because, as we all know, the Commerce Clause is more elastic than a fat man's underwear for a lot of years. So I treat it as a moral victory that five justices were unwilling to say that the Commerce Clause was sufficient to support the individual mandate. However, in a truly remarkable demonstration of intellectual flexibility, Chief Roberts did find this to be a proper exercise of the taxing power. Now, what is a tax? Tax is the thing that Congress levies to raise money. And if you have a tax rate of zero, you produce no money. Ergo, how can the thing be a tax? So the argument, and I think it's a sound argument, is that after the 2017 amendments, taxing power would no longer support the individual mandate as a constitutional basis to support the individual mandate as a legislative enactment. And the trial court so found. Here comes the problem, and I apologize for those that know this case, and I'm boring you because you know this. Sorry, Steve. But the problem comes with what do you do now? We've got an unconstitutional provision, a major provision. What happens to the rest? And the current state of the law is a curious amalgam of judicial activism. It, in the first instance, requires the judge to ask, what's left of the law comport with the intent of Congress? The second prong is to guess. It requires what I call magical thinking, to guess what the intent of Congress would have been if they had known that this piece was unconstitutional. Would they still have passed the law anyway, knowing about the unconstitutional provision? Well, more on that in just a second. In this case, the court said, yep, it's clearly inseverable. They didn't put a severability clause in, and they said six times that it was essential. Well, the problem with that is it's proof texting. You're pulling magic words out of a 1,800 or whatever page bill, and saying that's what that means, except for the one piece of hard evidence that we have about the intent of Congress. By the way, anybody know what a committee is? A committee is a thing that has six or more legs, six or more arms, and no discernible brain. I mean no serious disrespect, but when I joke that Congress has been referred to the largest committee as the in the history of Western democracy, okay, somebody could laugh at that. But how does one, as a practical matter, discern the intent of 535 individuals with respect to a huge piece of legislative verbiage that has been subject to extensive editing and horse trading? I have no idea how anybody could actually do that. Fortunately, the court really didn't need to worry about that because we have actual hard evidence about what Congress intended here. The Congress left in place all of the rest of the Affordable Care Act and just reduced that to zero, clearly evincing their sense that the Affordable Care Act provisions regarding the markets and the pre-existing conditions and keeping kids on your insurance until they're 26 could survive without the individual mandate. Well, what about those six times that they talked about it being essential? That's from 2010. It was their sense back before we had NFIB. It was their sense before it was amended 50 times, more than 50 times. It was their sense before the 2017 amendments or King versus Burwell. So the only way to read all of these things together and fairly understand it is that Congress was totally cool with it, and the trial court took the opportunity to strike a blow against Obamacare. Now, I didn't like Obamacare. I was against it and frankly thought it was unconstitutional before the Supreme Court twice told us that it is. But today, we have the law as it is, not as we might have thought it to be before it had been litigated. And I think that the district court is wrong. The reason I bring this up is because I'm really praying against all odds that this gets to the Supreme Court, because our brief sets up an argument in the Supreme Court that the precedents that establish this magical thinking test of what did Congress really mean and is what's left consistent with what they originally intended shouldn't be the issue at all. Justice Scalia talked about the idea of manifest purpose, manifest being the operative word there. We're not looking at some evanescent or imaginary intent of 535 individuals, but the actual purpose as is evidenced by the language of the statute itself. It is, of course, possible that a particular provision would be inseparable from the entire enactment. The assumption ought to be by the judiciary that the congressional language should be left intact as possible. It is the same thing to write a law as to repeal a law, and it doesn't match with the historical precedent prior to the establishment of the magical thinking doctrine. As I said in public, to boil this down, if the patient has a tumor, you don't kill the patient, you cut out the tumor. This is an important thing for us to think about because, like the judicially created deference doctrines that I talked about last year in administrative law, we also have here an expansive tool that can be used very subjectively by an activist judiciary, and we should be against that. I respect the judiciary. It is the emphatic province of the courts to say what the law is. It's also the emphatic province of the legislature to write the law. Or, as I like to say, being from an automotive state, Ford doesn't ask the accountants to design the cars. I appreciate the opportunity to come in and talk about this case and the work that my office is doing, and want to finish by telling you how much I respect you. I started by talking about how the five votes against finding the Commerce Clause as a reasonable basis for the individual mandate reflects in some degree the importance of the Federalist Society and the lawyers, practitioners, thinkers, judges that have followed this increasingly robust intellectual tradition. Without a text-based absolute kind of standard, as an objective standard outside our own opinion, we who are trained to argue either side of the case can convince ourselves that anything we want to do is justified and righteous. It is only in textualism and the objectivity that comes with actually looking at the text and the notice that we give the public of what the law is that we can truly have the rule of law and that we can truly have freedom. It is you and our colleagues across the country who have made that case, who have developed the intellectual tradition that now even people on the other side who are decidedly activists are beginning to cite these ideas in some of their reasoning, albeit with the end in mind. Many of you know I'm a musician, and I remember an old song by Billy Joel, and I'll leave you with the closing stanza of the song as a note of encouragement, because the light of the rule of law is never more than a generation from going out. The flame of a constitutional government, of the rule of law, of separation of powers, has to be forcefully advocated by able people who hold to that doctrine. Billy Joel said, "There's not many who still remember. They say a handful still remain to tell the world about the way the lights went out and keep the memory alive." Thank you for keeping the memory of the rule alive in our generation. Thank you very much.